طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week with the words of Richard Falk, writing in response to the withdrawal by the United Nations of the report he wrote with Virginia Tilley investigating Israel's crime of apartheid. Of course, the critical report was attacked by the dynamic duo of Israel and the United States, and these bullies were successful in getting the report withdrawn. The Executive Secretary of the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia, which authorized the report, Rima Khalaf, resigned in protest of this outrageous, cowardly act of the United Nations. Richard Falk, former professor of international law at Princeton University, served for 6 years as United Nations Human Rights Council's special rapporteur on human rights in Palestine. He writes, and I quote, "Israeli leaders have warned for decades that if a separate Palestinian state wasn't established, their country would become an apartheid state. I arrived in Edinburgh on March 13th to begin a 10-day string of speaking engagements arranged by my publisher, Pluto, to launch my new book, Palestine's Horizon, Towards a Just Peace. The Scottish phase of the visit went smoothly enough, with well-attended talks and discussions in Aberdeen, Glasgow, Edinburgh, on the main themes of the book. Then, on March 15th, the calm was shattered. The UN Economic and Social Commission for West Asia released a report that I co-authored with Virginia Tilley, a political scientist at the University of Southern Illinois, that examined the question as to whether sufficient evidence existed to conclude that Israel's forms of control exercised over the Palestinian people amounted to the international crime of apartheid. It was an academic study that analyzed the relevant issues from the perspective of international law and summarized Israel's practices and policies that were alleged to be discriminatory. Before being released, the study had been sent by the Commission for review to three distinguished international experts on human rights and international law, each of whom submitted highly favorable reports as to the scholarly contribution of the report. So why the perfect storm? As soon as it was released in Beirut at a press conference where both Professor Tilley and I participated by Skype, the furor commenced. First came denunciations of the report by the recently designated American ambassador at the UN, Nikki Haley, and by the firebrand Israeli diplomat Danny Dannon. This was quickly followed by a statement released by the newly elected UN General Secretary Antonio Guterres, indicating that the report as it stands does not represent the views of the Secretary General, and was released without consultations with the UN Secretariat. The director of the UN Economic and Social Commission, Rima Khalaf, holding the high rank of Deputy Secretary General, was instructed to remove our report from the Commission website and chose to resign on principle rather than follow the order. There is much fake news surrounding this response to our report that it becomes difficult to sift truth from rumor. Ambassador Halley, for instance, self-righteously declared, "When someone issues a false and defamatory report in the name of the UN, it is appropriate that the person resign." The report was clearly labeled as being the work of independent scholars and did not necessarily reflect the views of the UN or the Commission. In other words, it was not a UN report, nor had it been endorsed by the UN. Beyond this, how could it be false and defamatory when its analysis amounted to no more or less than a scholarly interpretation of a legal concept and a presentation of Israeli practices? Ambassador Dannon, along with Haley, called the report despicable and a blatant lie. He apparently forgot that a series of Israeli leaders had warned since at least 1967 that if there was no separate Palestinian state established soon, Israel would become an apartheid state. Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, put the issue this way in a radio address, quote, "Israel better rid itself of the territories and their Arab population as soon as possible. If it did not, Israel would soon become an apartheid state," unquote. Or consider what Yitzhak Rabin, the two-time prime minister of Israel, told a TV journalist back in 1976. Quote, "I don't think it's possible to contain over the long term, if we don't want to get to apartheid, 1.5 million Arabs inside a Jewish state." Unquote. And more definitively, from a legal perspective, Michael Ben-Yair, a former Israeli attorney general, concluded, quote, "We established an apartheid regime in the occupied territories," unquote. It should be clear from these statements, and there are many others, that an investigation of apartheid in the Israeli context is not something outrageous or even particularly new, although our study does break new ground. It looks at the contention of apartheid as applicable to the Palestinian people as a whole, and not just those living under occupation. This means including refugees, involuntary exiles, the minority in Israel, and residents of Jerusalem within a coherent overall structure of systematic discriminatory domination. It also examines whether Israeli practices rise to a level of clarity and intentionality to satisfy the notion of apartheid as it is defined by the 1973 Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid. Ambassador Dannon also accuses the study of creating a false analogy, presumably a reference to the South African apartheid system. The study, rather than claiming an analogy, goes out of its way to argue that international crime of apartheid has nothing to do with its historical connections with South Africa, a racist regime, and that Israel's control over the Palestinian people proceeds in a wholly different manner. For instance, South Africa's leaders claim to be proud of apartheid as a beneficial system of racial separation, while Israel's leaders seek to affirm Israel as a democratic state that rejects racism. What this discussion of this fallout from the report shows, above all, is the refusal by Israel and its supporters to engage in reasoned discussion of an admittedly controversial set of conclusions. Instead, it is better to wound the messengers rather than respond to the message. Part of the pushback at the UN was to brand me as biased and an anti-Semite, drawing on a series of defamatory attacks that I endured while serving as UN Special Rapporteur on Israeli violations in occupied Palestine. This is part of a trend in recent years in which supporters of Israel move to close down critical discussion rather than to respond substantively. In my view, such tactics are a reflection of how weak Israel's positions have become on such contested issues as settlements, excessive force, Jerusalem residency, discriminatory laws and regulations, and diversion of water. So writes Richard Falk. It appears from their mischaracterization of the report that neither our ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, nor the Israeli diplomat, Danny Dannon, even read the report before their knee-jerk response. So the bullies have to be exposed and refuted, and they are, on an international scale. And now, on to our feature presentation this morning, which is a talk given this past week at the JFK School of Government by Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu. She is introduced by Professor Hilary Rantizi and speaks on the topic of the one-state solution in the Trump era.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Diana Boutu back to campus. Many of you are here because you know who Diana is, so I won't go extensively into everything that she has done, but I'll do a brief introduction. She's here to discuss a very timely topic, but I think it's always timely. There's always so much going on, and we're privileged to have her with us on campus. There'll be time for Q&A after Diana gives some remarks, and so if you could wait with your comments, questions until that period of time, that would be appreciated. So Diana Boutu is a Palestinian-Canadian lawyer specializing in negotiations, international law, and international human rights law. She's currently a visiting professor at the University of Windsor Law School in Windsor, Ontario, and was formerly a legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team. Shortly after receiving one of her degrees, she has four law degrees. From Queen's University, she has a law degree from Queen's University, has a law degree from Stanford University, and from University of Toronto, as well as an MBA from Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, and a bachelor's in Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies. So as a scholar, as a practitioner, and someone who has been in the field, she's very well positioned to be speaking to us today. But Diana she's no stranger to Harvard. She was a fellow with us at the Middle East Initiative a few years ago, and visits us from time to time, but she also teaches at the Extension School also on a regular basis, negotiation skills. So you may also enroll in a class of hers.
Of course.
She's taught at Peer Zayt University and held a fellowship at Stanford Center for Conflict Resolution and Negotiation, serves as a policy advisor for Al-Shabaka Palestinian Policy Network, and frequently comments on Palestine for international media outlets, and I'm sure many of you have heard her on NPR, seen her on CNN, and other outlets. So please join me in welcoming Diana Boutu.
When you had the storm again, so I didn't make it here, and I'm
I'm glad to see that you all survived. Thank you very much for the introduction. What's interesting with this topic of Trump and the one-state solution is that I think it was exactly 5 years ago this weekend, if I'm not mistaken, or 2 weekends ago,
beginning of March,
that we had a conference at Harvard on the one-state solution. It was in March of 2012. Okay. And at the time, it brought together a number of different scholars and activists working on the issue of Palestine and working on the one-state solution, brought them together in Harvard, and it was an absolutely wonderful conference. And so here I am 5 years later. And we should be saying, well, you failed. But actually, feel from what I'm going to talk about today is that this is the era, this is what we are slowly moving into in terms of the one-state solution. So February 15th, there was a meeting between the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and your brand new fresh president, President Trump. I'm not going to say anything about him. And during the meeting, at the end of the meeting, or at the beginning of the meeting, excuse me, Trump says, I quote, he says, I'm looking at two state and one state, and I like the one that both parties like. I can live with either one. If Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy. And so for a lot of people, a lot of commentators who heard this, they were very quick to dismiss President Trump's statement. This is a rookie president, and as one person said to me, he treats everybody like he's treating the person who puts up his drywall. He seems to be just kind of, you know, whatever works, it works for me. And so a lot of people were quite dismissive and said, absolutely, this is insane. You can't veer off of the two-state track, and that what he's going to do is send us down to a very, very bad path. And instead, he should be focusing on bringing the parties back, bringing them back to a negotiations process. And so this is definitely not a defense of President Trump in it. No way do I want anybody to interpret this as being a defense of President Trump. But what I do want to say is that I think that the opening up of this space was and is very important. Now, I want to say at the beginning, the version of one state that Trump may be envisioning and the one that Netanyahu might be conceiving of is not the vision of a one state that I want to be part of. It's the vision of the one state that I am part of, which is the vision of one state that most Israelis are talking about is a one state in which Israel is dominant and the Palestinians are, in quotes, allowed to remain in the country. So provided that they can demonstrate some measure of loyalty, provided that they simply stay quiet, provided that they do not resist in any way, provided that they simply internalize that they have been defeated, then the theory goes, and they should be allowed to live in one state. That being said, their rights are marginal and conditional upon how good citizens they are towards the Israelis and towards the idea of a Jewish state. So that's not what I'm talking about. But sadly, this is where we are going. So when we talk about one state, I want to be clear that what I'm talking about in terms of one state, one-state solution. I don't like the word solution because it implies that we're a problem. What I'm talking about in terms of one state is a state in which there's equality for all, in which we've broken down the system of privilege that exists in the country and instead are working towards an idea of equality of individuals and of citizenship. That's not what's in play. So why is it that we are moving towards this one state, the one state that already exists? There's a number of different factors, and I'm going to try to go through all like three segments of them. The first is reality on the ground. The second is the very weak international community. And the third is the Palestinian Authority. So I'm going to begin by focusing on the facts on the ground. What I think a lot of people tend to dismiss in terms of the facts on the ground is that The number of settlements that have increased over the period of time since Oslo began is practically, is practically threefold. The number of settlements is practically doubled since Oslo began. And today, looking at the West Bank, we're now talking about some 600,000 plus settlers, on the ground. And that number is increasing daily. Just since the beginning of the year, there have been various reports, but somewhere between a number of 3,000 and 6,000 new housing units that have been announced since the beginning of the year, and construction actively in place on over an additional 800 units. Now, this is one of the largest pushes for settlements since Oslo began, and in particular in this short period of time. So it's as though the Israelis have used the coming in of the Trump administration to press the green light and move fast ahead to continue to build and expand settlements. At the same time, the number of houses that the Israelis are demolishing, Palestinian houses that the Israelis are demolishing, is reaching a crisis point, where we see that the number of homes, that the Israeli authorities demolished in 2016 far surpassed the years that had preceded it, with in some cases double the years prior. So we've got this combination of an increase in the number of settlers that are living in the country, living in the West Bank, an increase in the number of settlements that are going up, increase in the number of home demolitions against Palestinians that are happening. And what all of this is indicating is that this is not, by the way, coming out of a vacuum. This isn't just, you know, some sort of machinery that is moving along. One of the big and fundamental issues that people tend to ignore when we're moving towards this issue of one state is the power of the pro-settlement political parties that are in Israel's landscape. So since the late 80s, there has not been a single Israeli government that has managed to stay in power for the entire duration of its electoral period. And the reason is that in Israel, coalitions need to be formed in order to maintain a government. And what the pro-settlement right wing has learned is that the way that you can get more power is by forming smaller political parties, which the larger political parties have to align with, have to create a coalition with, in order to be able to remain in office. So it's not at all surprising that you see that alongside the rise of these pro-settlement political parties, that you're seeing a rise in the amount of settlements that are being constructed. But I don't want to place the blame just on these pro-settlement political parties, because they're just simply doing what people do in politics, which is they advocate and push for what it is that they want, as abhorrent as these settlement parties are. It also goes back not just to these settlement parties themselves, but to the bigger parties as well. So, for example, Likud has not ever endorsed any real idea of a Palestinian state. They've been shifty on it. They've talked about all of the various limitations that they would have to any sort of two-state solution. But it's always been quite shifty, and in their shiftiness, they've allowed these pro-settlement political parties to be able to exploit. And so this is why we are now beginning to see, this is why we're now living in the reality in which there are far more settlements, and the settlement groups have a lot, they have a disproportionate support and disproportionate weight within the government. This is why, for those of you, I don't know who's been paying attention, but you saw most recently with the demolition of Amona, the Israeli outpost of Amona in the West Bank. This was an outpost that was built on private Palestinian land. And for anybody who knows about the legal system inside Israel, the only place that you cannot build a settlement is on privately registered Palestinian land. So the landowners, alongside with an Israeli NGO called the Ashdin, came together, filed a lawsuit, and 20 years later, took 20 years, they managed to secure the evacuation of the illegal settlement outpost of Amman. In response, these pro-settlement groups that I've been talking about began to put forth legislation, it's been in the works for quite some time, to actually go against the Amona situation. So the legislation that they've put into place and that just got passed in February 6th and now in effect since February 13th is a law that actually, they call it the regularization bill, should be called the land theft bill. And what it does is it actually retroactively gives retroactive legal status to any settlement outpost that is built on private Palestinian land. So as I was saying, the Israelis have crafted this wonderful, very intricate system when it comes to settlements and what settlements are considered legal and illegal. And the one thing that you cannot do in Israel is you cannot build on private Palestinian land. And here comes the regularization bill, the land theft bill, that is designed to actually do that. It's designed to retroactively give legal legitimacy to any settlement that is built on private Palestinian land. Now, why is this so important? It's important because it highlights the very issue that I was speaking of a little bit earlier, which is not just the power of the pro-settlement groups within Knesset, but that on their own, the pro-settlement groups within Knesset would never have been able to pass this law. But it's the marriage of the pro-settlement groups inside the Knesset alongside these other bigger parties inside Israel that have allowed and that have made it such that this bill, this land theft law, is now a law that is going to be in place. And you know, it may be something that will be overturned in the Supreme Court. We'll wait and see. That's not the point. The point of the matter is that these are the forces that are in play inside Israel today. We've got forces in play that are pushing for more and more settlements. We've got forces in play that are pushing for more and more home demolitions. Forces in play that are pushing for Palestinians to be stripped of their right. Forces in play that are pushing for more land confiscation. And forces in play that are pushing for all of these settlements to be viewed retroactively. And now there's also a push in play to push for the annexation of the West Bank minus those Palestinian towns. So we are pushing towards a scenario of the one state that I was talking about, the state that I don't want to see in, but it's the state that I live in. It's moving gradually towards that. And you can contrast this with apartheid in South Africa. And I want to contrast it, not make the similarity, I want to contrast it with apartheid in South Africa. There's been a lot of people who've made the connections between apartheid in Israel and apartheid in South Africa, and there are a number of different, there are a number of similarities. The one big difference, though, is that in apartheid South Africa, when there was a push and this view that establishing independent homelands, the Bantustans, when that was pushed and when that was an idea, the idea was to make their lives so good in the homelands or in the Bantustans so that they wouldn't be pushing for equal rights. And you should contrast that with the way that life is for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, where they're making life so bad within these little independent areas that they claim to be wanting to have as a two-state solution. So in other words, Israel is not making it any better or any more attractive to push towards this idea of having a Palestinian state. In fact, it's the opposite. They've made it particularly clear that you will never have your own independent state. You will never be able to live your life freely, and instead you will be relegated to living as second-class citizens, whether it's under equal statehood or it's under equal citizenship. Not equal citizenship. So it's whether it's under two states or under one state. So that's where the Israeli landscape is, politically. We can talk in question Q&A about where they are in terms of the social fabric. I'm not going to get into that, but I'm sure you... I'm sure you have your own thoughts, and I'm happy to fill in when it comes to questions. How about on the international community side? The problem on the international community side is just about the same. So there's been a decision that's been in place now for several decades, since at least the early 90s, to push for the two-state solution. And you hear that. I mean, I can practically say these things blindly now. Like, I can almost read out the statements that the international community now has. I can do it verbatim practically now. They support two states. They support a negotiated process. They support whatever the two sides support has to be on the basis of international law, international legitimacy, and so on and so forth. And this has been the international community's position now for more than since the 90s. We're approaching close to 30 years. The problem is that there are no teeth to this statement of what it is that they actually believe in. And so any talk of veering off of the two-state option is akin to heresy, particularly in the minds of the Europeans. And being that it is akin to heresy, the only thing that they continue to speak of is the two-state solution, but at the same time, ignoring the reality on the ground. So, for example, and I'll just give you a very quick example. So, for example, there isn't a single country in the world, including this country, that recognizes the legitimacy of Israel's rule over East Jerusalem. Not a single country, including this one, as much as people may think that it's the other way around. And yet, as lawyers, the one thing that Palestinians are often forced to do is, because the system is so weak, we're forced to use the very court and the very system that the international community does not recognize as legitimate. So, for example, for a Palestinian who's trying to block their home from being demolished, as lawyers, we were always told, oh, go to the Israeli Supreme Court, go to the Israeli High Court, go to this, go to that, you know, use the Israeli system. And yet this is the very system that they've said that they do not recognize its legitimacy over when it comes to Palestinians. So here's where the lack of teeth come in. When there are pushes for things such as to hold Israel accountable, whether it's in the form of BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, or whether it's in the other form of incentives, all that we've seen that has happened when it comes from the international community is that we see the incentives come in place, but no disincentives. So Israel gets cajoled a lot to do the right thing, but when they don't do anything, oh, so what? And when we end up pushing for boycotts or for divestment or for sanctions, again, nothing is happening. So you see that the combination of the two, of the weakness of the international community and this fast-forward effect of building and expanding settlements, has meant that the international community is now completely out of touch with reality on the ground. They are a good 20 years behind with what is happening on the ground. So instead, they continue to issue the same statements, but there are no teeth or no effect given to this idea of what they actually believe as being two states. And this has had an impact on Israel itself. You know, settlements can be uprooted. I'm the first to say it. It was done in Sinai, it was done in Gaza. Settlements can be uprooted. They're just physical structures. They can be demolished. It's not a big deal. But what can't be demolished, and what's happened now as we're approaching 50 years of military occupation, is there's a mindset that has now been entrenched inside Israel that this land is Israel's, and that Palestinians are simply interlopers. That's the part that we have to get towards changing. Now, the third factor that is pushing towards one state is that of the PA. So the PA was initially conceived of as being a body that would be in place for just a short period of time It was supposed to be a transitional government that was going to govern the affairs of Palestinians. And it's not at all surprising that where you see the powers of the PA were simply confined to people. Because if you think of what Israel wants, is that it wants the land, it doesn't want the people. And they wanted to have somebody who'd be able to govern over the people. So if you look jurisdictionally at where it is that the Palestinian Authority operates, they're in control, if you can even call it that, of a mere 18% of the West Bank. So, you know, 18% of the 22%, so a tiny little spot. And if you add in the other areas that they have some form of, like, civil control, meaning that they control the textbooks and the schools and the hospitals, etc., it adds up to 40% of the West Bank. Right, so 40% of the 22%. But population-wise, the population is actually 98% of Palestinians of the West Bank. So you see that they've effectively, through Oslo, this mechanism of getting rid of the burden of having to rule over Palestinians, but while being able to take as much land, has actually worked. So Israel's still in control of 60% of the West Bank, and on that 60% there's really only 2% of Palestinians. The Palestinian Authority, on the other hand, 40% of the land, 98% of the people on that land. Now, that model was supposed to just be for a short period, supposed to be for a five-year period. And after the five-year period, we were supposed to be living in freedom, waving our little flags, etc., having our own airport, and so on. So we're well past that. Oslo was signed in 1993, so here we are in 2017. I'll let you do the math because I'm not very good at it. MBA and all. Yeah. math is not my strong suit. So here we are, you know, some 24 years later, and we're further away from liberation than we were 24 years ago. And the problem now is that the legitimacy that the Palestinian Authority had in the 90s is not the legitimacy that they have today. And I don't just mean to imply the characters. I'll talk about the characters in just a second. But of the structure of the Palestinian Authority itself. Remember, the idea was that it was supposed to be just for a five-year period, a temporary period, until it could be demonstrated that there was a mechanism to transition power, to transition land, as abhorrent as that is. I actually think that it's a flawed model. But the idea was just, we're going to have to go through some temporary pain to get long-term gain. That idea is no longer acceptable in Palestine. And the temporary pain that I'm talking about is that the Palestinian Authority was required to, in effect, be Israel's security subcontractor. And people at the beginning of Oslo, Palestinians at the beginning of Oslo, there were a lot of people who, there was a lot of discontent. But by and large, people accepted that model because they actually believed that this short-term period was going to lead to long-term gain. So short-term pain was going to lead to long-term gain. What's happened since is the exact opposite. People no longer believe that this structure is actually going to lead to liberation, and to the contrary, they see it now precisely as being the security subcontractor to Israel. So instead of the Palestinian Authority being in place to lead towards liberation, the Palestinian Authority is now viewed as being the mechanism that is taking us away from liberation. And you see this in the number of polls that, and a variety of different polls that have come out, with polls coming out. I think it's either 62 or 63. It's a one-point difference. Let's go on the 62 side just so that I'm not entirely inaccurate. 62% of Palestinians saying not just that they don't support Mahmoud Abbas, the current president, but that they believe he should resign. So this is not a poll that's saying, I don't support him, like the way that you get the presidential polls in Europe, in the United States and prime ministerial polls in Canada, which they have support for the president or support for the prime minister, etc. These are 62% of people saying that he should resign. That's a very high number. And in addition to the numbers of the percentage of people saying that he should resign, support for the Palestinian Authority itself, and remember, this is the single largest employer of all Palestinians in the West Bank, is in the low 30s. So the single largest employer gets low 30s support. The man who heads the single largest employer, 62% of people are saying that he should resign. That whole structure has led to people questioning whether the two-state model is the model that they believe in. And in fact, polls are beginning to show that the support for one state among Palestinians, and these are the people who are supposed to be the beneficiaries of a state, beneficiaries of independence, support for it is on the decline, and support for one state is on the rise. With some polls, usually around 20 to 30%. Oh, you'll say 20 to 30%, it's not very high. This is 20 to 30% without there being a single political party in place advocating for one state. There isn't a single political party inside Israel. There isn't a single political party among Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Not a single political party is pushing and advocating for one state. And yet you see these increased numbers of people saying that they support one state. So what can account for it? It's all of the above. The process of negotiations that I said, I started at the beginning by saying some of the pundits were saying, no, this man is insane, he's crazy, we have to go back to negotiations. The process of negotiations gets even lower support among Palestinians, where Palestinians are saying, we cannot continue to go down that path. You know, I was part of the negotiations process many, many, many moons ago. And I can tell you, having been involved in those negotiations, that there's nothing, zero, nothing, that can be done to change the structural flaws that were in place during that negotiations process. Nothing. The negotiations were flawed before we even got into the room. The idea that a very weak party living under military rule is to negotiate their freedom with their occupier is completely flawed. And we tried it, and Palestinians tried it. They tried to the best of their ability. The structural flaws cannot work. So what will work, given that this is where I see things that are going? I think that where we are going to end up is we will end up with this one state that the Israeli right wing, the pro-settlement movement, is advocating. It's a one state that is an apartheid, which is where we are. We're just a few shades away from having it be to a point where you can say, all right, there's one law that's over this land and governing two different peoples. It's already there in some shapes, but in other ways it's... It's just a little shy of being exactly that. This is where we are going to end up. And increasingly, we're going to see people who are struggling for full equality. Already, we're beginning to see these rifts inside, or this movement inside Israel, among Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, such as me, who are pushing for much more equality within the state. There is not full equality, even among Israeli citizens, and we can talk about that if you're interested. But this is where the trend is moving. So while on the one hand we are going to see the further to the right, the pushing into place of this full-blown apartheid system, unless there's something done to stop it, and I just don't see that the international community is capable of stopping it, and I don't think inside Israel they're capable of stopping it either. While we're pushing towards that, the reverse is going to be that more and more individuals are going to continue to push for equality within the state. Where that will lead us, I don't know. I hope I'm not back in 5 years to explain. I hope I'm back in 5 years with some better news. So I'm going to stop there and open it up for questions.
You have been listening to a presentation given by Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu at the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.